All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Bob Gould.
Okay, welcome once again to Veterans Radio. Bob Gould right here, coming to you from our flagship station, WAAM, 1600 AM on the dial, or also veteransradio.net if you want to catch us on the internet. Okay. Hey, I'm not getting a good signal. Well, try the internet. Anyway, we have got a program today. It's very current. There's things going on in the Middle East we've got to know about. And, of course, we brought the one person who can tell us all about that, and that's Dr. Rebecca Grant. She's going to be with us in just a moment, telling us all about Russia, Syria, Mosul, ISIS, Sunnis, Shia, Kurds. Good Lord, who can keep track of all that stuff? Well, we're going to hope to take care of that, all right, in just a minute. But here's a couple of announcements coming up. You know, we got Veterans Day. Yes, that's going to be coming up very shortly. And there's going to be a lot of giveaways for veterans, including meals and haircuts. For example, the Great Clips. There we go. Great Clips. And let me get to that. There we go. Great Clips are going to be offering on November 11th. They either get a free haircut or a free haircut card. Okay, that's kind of like get out of jail, you know, whenever you need one, you got one. So this is going to be good through December 31st. So that's going to be U.S. Great Clips Salons, right? And there's over 4,000 of them, so you ought to be able to find one, and they're all franchised. Oh, what does that mean? Well, that means that not all of them may be participating. It doesn't say here on the release whether they are, but a lot of times some of the franchises forego that, although it would be kind of hard to imagine anybody do that to veterans, but it's always best to ask first. But that's going to be on November 11th. You either get a free haircut or a free haircut card. That sounds pretty cool. And while you're at it, you can have yourself a meal. So get yourself a haircut and get a meal over at the Golden Corral Restaurants. They salute America's heroes with the 16th annual free dinner appreciation night. Okay, when is that? This will be Golden Corral will serve free dinner buffets with beverage. I don't believe that's going to, I don't think they have alcohol beverage. No, that must just mean Coke or what. From 5 p.m. to 9 p.m., don't worry about that. On November the 14th, to any person who is or has been in the military branch, including the National Guard and Reserves. Okay. Gary Sinise, who's been promoting Golden Corral and is also going to be hosting spots and things. This is his 12th year. He's quoted, "This is my 12th year. I've had the pleasure to partner with Golden Corral in supporting our troops, past and present, through Appreciation Night." The number of meals given away and amount of money donated to the past 15 years recall Golden Corral's commitment to the military. I'm proud and happy to raise awareness for Golden Corral Military Appreciation Night. Boy, that's really cool. Yeah, so that's Golden. And then there's going to be many, many more. I know Applebee's always on Veterans Day. They have meals. And so it's from a selected menu, but it's really, really cool. It's really cool to see people doing that. Okay? Yes. Don't forget, fly a flag. Why not? Got a flag? Who cares what size? Small, medium, large, big? Fly it. Put it somewhere. Put it in the window of your car. Veterans Day coming up. Salute to veterans. And speaking of saluting, we're going to be right back to salute Dr. Rebecca Grant and talking about, Russia, Mosul, Syria. I'm trying. Drones. Yes, the enemy has drones. Can you believe that? Who knew, right? I didn't know. Well, you're going to find all about that in just a moment. So take it away, Chauncey. And we're back on Veterans Radio. Bob Gould hosting today. You know, I'm looking in the paper today, and there's nothing going. There's a huge battle right now going on in Moselle and the area around it, and we're not covering it. What the heck is going on around? Yes, we don't know. And when you think of all the players, Russia, the U.S., Britain, Iraq, Syria, Turkey, I hope I haven't left any, but China, yeah, North Korea, they're all involved in this, folks. But mostly the big battle of Mosul. And now one of our frequent guests on Veterans Radio, somebody we call on every now and then to tell us what the heck is really going on, to cut through all the baloney and to get right down to the meat of things, is Dr. Rebecca Grant. She is the director of the General Billy Mitchell Institute for Air Power. She actually was the director of the General Billy Mitchell Institute for Air Power Studies at the Air Force Association, and she's a contributing editor for the Air Force Magazine. Boy, I'd like to get a copy of that. Maybe I'll just go online and find that, right? Okay. Dr. Grant is a senior fellow at the Lexington Institute. She earned her PhD degree in international relations from the London School of Economics and has worked for RAND, that's one of the policy people, and the United States Air Force. In 1995, Dr. Grant founded IRIS. Let's not confuse that with what we're going to be talking about today. That's IRIS, Independence Research. She's the president. They're the think tank for the Air Force. Let's give a big hand just before Halloween for Dr. Rebecca Grant. Rebecca Grant, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hey, Bob. I'm delighted to be back on Veterans Radio. How are you?
Oh, boy. I can't wait to turn. Give me about one more minute here, because I got your email and I want to be going into this. There's no information before we get started. Real quick for the folks back home out here that really don't understand who the players are. We have the Sunnis. Who are the Sunnis? Well, Saddam Hussein was. He was part of the Ba'ath Party, which was part of the Sunnis. The Sunnis were in government. When he got toppled, they all got kicked out. And the Shiites moved in. Right. And now they have control of the government. But that made the Sunnis mad. So the Sunnis partnered with Al-Qaeda, and Al-Qaeda splintered branches, ISIS. ISIS has been doing all the dirty work. Now the Russians are involved. Yes, the Russians are involved. The Syrians, and the Syrians at one time, folks, figure this one out. I'm trying to think of it. President Assad, I think his name is Assad. Assad, there we are. He was the enemy. We were going to go take this guy out, and we're not doing that. Everything's going on in his country. There's this huge battle now, and it seems to be the tug of war between all the forces. And this is it. Mosul, Dr. Grant, tell us about that.
Well, Bob, you did really well. I'm going to give you 99 out of 100 on your Middle East politics quiz. You're right, it is a big tug of war. And let me add, you talked about the Sunnis, of course, and the Shia. There's another important set of players in the Middle East, and that would be the Kurds. Sometimes you'll see them described as the Peshmerga, the Kurdish forces. This is a group, it's an ethnic group, very powerful, that's in the northern part of the state of Iraq. And they have been holding down the northern, really sort of the northeastern border area around Mosul. So they are part of what you call the tug of war, Bob. That's a really good description of it. So get out your map. I tell you, it is so hard. And you are so right to say that we are just not reading enough about this in the newspapers. You'd expect to see almost daily reports. And there is some coverage, yes, but I think there's a lot more going on here. And so let's try to fill in where we are. On October 17th, the Iraqi government forces started an offensive, which they'd been planning a pretty long time, to go and retake Mosul. So Mosul is a pretty big city in Iraq. It sits across the Tigris River, but it was taken by the ISIS, the Islamic State forces, back in more than 2 years ago, actually, back in June of 2014. they took it over at that time, and pretty much since then, the Iraqis have known they want to go back in and take that city. It reminded me almost a little bit of Douglas MacArthur in the Philippines. What did he say about the Philippines, Bob? Do you remember that?
No, I don't.
I shall return, right? So, you know, he knew as soon as MacArthur and everybody was kicked out of the Philippines in World War II that he wanted to come back. So, no surprise that the Iraqis are leading an offensive back into Mosul. What about the American role? So, really happening in three different ways. One is a lot of leadership involvement. So our central command senior officers there, our 3 and 4-star generals, have done a lot of work advising the Iraqis in how to put this offensive together. So part one is senior command, you know, review the briefings, are your plans together, okay, go. Other two very important areas. One, of course, is air power. They have actually dropped, between bombs and precision artillery, it's been about 2,000 rounds in the last 10 days. That's a lot of ordnance over there. So we're really seeing an uptick in the airstrikes and some heavy artillery strikes there supporting this offensive. And then the final way that we're supporting is a little harder to put our fingers on. That's with advise and assist missions to assist the Iraqi forces. Some of this is boots on the ground. Some of this is our fantastic special forces who are providing surveillance of the area and also kind of pointing the Iraqis in the right direction. No one talks very much about what these missions involve. I think we can kind of picture it. But it's a lot like what we did in Afghanistan back in 2001, and that is assisting the local forces, in this case primarily Iraqi army, with identifying where the enemy, the ISIS resistance, is and how to maneuver or strike against them in order to take ground. So big advise and assist role going on there, and you can be sure that there most likely are some American boots on the ground providing really direct assistance as the Iraqis and the Kurds close in on Mosul.
Now, you'd mentioned airstrikes. Now, there is an air coalition. Who's in that coalition?
Right. That's a pretty big coalition, and it's got a changing set of players. Here's who you'll pretty much always find. That is, first off, the U.S. with the U.S. Air Force, but also United States Navy, Marine Corps as well. You'll almost always find the British involved, the Royal Air Force, a terrific frontline force. Beyond that, we have a kind of a shifting group of other NATO allies and partners. It's quite common to see countries like France or Spain or Australia involved in the air coalition. Sometimes also we see local Gulf region allies, and they often would rather not have their names in the paper, but we do see some of the Arab Air Forces who are very proficient and have top-level equipment. We sometimes see them participating as well. So it's U.S.-led, but it is very much a coalition air fight, and that's really the same coalition that was put together after 9/11 and first really came together in Afghanistan. And like I said, the players do change now and again. A country will be in or be out, or it'll rotate forces in, rotate them out. Some countries don't participate in all operations, but it is a very international group of airmen. And a great thing about the airmen particularly is English is the language of aviation, so it's particularly easy for our allied and partner air forces to work together because they share this common language. And now they also have almost 2 decades worth of experience operating together. So they're a very, very effective coalition, but with our United States Air Force and United States Navy and Marine Corps as sort of the central hub of the air power in the Central Command region.
Now, where are these planes are coming from? Are they coming from carriers? Are they coming from carriers and land based? And if it's land based, where are they coming from?
Yeah, so the majority is land based because that's the way that's easiest to maintain the support and have the repair and logistics facilities. They're coming from a number of, quote, undisclosed locations. So it's been widely reported that we have a large base and command facilities in Qatar. But these forces can come from all around as well. And again, things vary depending on how the host nation feels about, do they want their name to be publicized? Are you allowed to use their airfields for certain types of operations? But there are many, many regional bases that are now quite well established that provide the air power necessary, particularly in the surge operation that we're seeing here with the fighting going on the ground in Mosul.
When you say that it's not disclosed, why is that?
Well, that will vary with the that's the diplomats who decide on that one. If a country particularly doesn't want its name to be mentioned for various reasons, and that's they'll say, hey, come on in, use the airfield, we'll work with you, but please just don't have our name in the press too often, and we usually agree to that. An interesting thing, though, that has happened as a result of this offensive is our forces actually took back an airbase that had kind of been in the ISIS, the caliphate territory, and it's a base called Q West. It's a big base just a little bit, actually, I think it's a little bit south of Mosul, and what they needed to do was to, it had been just torn up and terrible, so they needed to bring in the civil engineers. And you know from the Vietnam era how important our engineering forces are to going in, and they sometimes go in really tough conditions, nothing there, and sometimes there's still some unexploded ordnance or, live fire going on. But in this case, our Air Force civil engineer group went in and poured 1.9 million pounds of rapid set concrete at Q West so that they could bring in the C-130 transport aircraft, which they need to help support the ground forces. And they got those C-130s in and landing there within a matter of days. So a very impressive achievement that they were able to, repair the damage and get this airfield up and running just very quickly after it had been recaptured from ISIS territory.
I want to read a quote here. And again, we're not being political, folks, okay? We're not. These people say this stuff in a newspaper. We can say it. We can read it over here in the air. One of the candidates had stated on a tweet that our campaign against the Islamic State group, well, here's the quote, is a total disaster. Now, I don't see that happening. Why don't you comment on that, Dr. Grant?
Yes. Well, there's only one candidate who likes to use Twitter. They both do, I guess. But, of course, this is Donald J. Trump tweeting from his real Donald Trump account. And I actually went and looked this up as well because, you always got to see what's the latest, right? And we were talking about how not hearing enough about Mosul, and so here we are. So the tweet reads, from October 23rd, the attack on Mosul is turning out to be a total disaster. We gave them months of notice. U.S. is looking so dumb, and then it ends, vote Trump, which is how they typically end their tweets. So, kind of an interesting thing. So I'll give a little background. It was about in August that both candidates, both Secretary Clinton and Donald Trump, began to receive daily intelligence briefings. And this is sort of part of the normal process that happens at this phase in every presidential election, that both nominees will begin to receive, I don't know if they're classified, but, kind of very confidential briefings about here's what's going on in the world, just so you know, here's what's going on. And so I, of course, have no idea what's in these briefings, but, it's pretty easy to speculate that there would have been some coverage of what's going on in Mosul. And this is about the time that they start to plan to really come into the final phases of this. So he obviously knows this is going to go on at some point in time. The other thing that really struck me about this is, he says it's a disaster. Disaster is kind of one of his words. Usually it's Obamacare is a disaster. He uses disaster like my 11-year-old uses the word totally. It just comes out all the time. So oh, it's a disaster, it's this and that, this and that. But, you know, I think his central point here is, you know, we gave them months of notice. And, of course, I always, just personally, I never like to see anyone say the U.S. is looking so dumb. That's kind of, well, it kind of hurts. But I will say, you know, he's talking about giving them notice, and that actually is, in a fact checker, that's true. The part of the plan was to notify so that civilians could move out if they were able to do so. I don't know how many people in Mosul did that. But, you know, it's an interesting kind of quote. I think he hasn't, what's interesting to me is he hasn't said anything since then. And the Pentagon came out 3 days later and gave a pretty good description of what is going on with this offensive. And they do a lot of forecasting as well. You know, the Pentagon talks about, right, we're working on Mosul now. We know that the next part of this is to continue on and take one of the northern cities above Mosul that's up in Syria. So I think, you know, this is sort of war in the modern age. It's something you... There are live tweets coming out of Mosul itself, live tweets coming out of Aleppo. You know, we just live in an information environment. So I think, you know, we aren't really broadcasting our intentions. We knew for a long time that there'd be an Iraqi offensive to try to retake Mosul.
Well, I'm still trying to think about, maybe we can approach it with the, what we're doing there, folks, is we're using intel on the ground and drones rather than boots on the ground and putting American service people in the line of fire, which I support 1,000%, not the line of fire, of using intel to find out where these ISIS leaders are, and that intel's got to be cool because they had a problem not too long ago. A couple days ago, where it's assumed that the U.S. Had an airstrike that mistook a funeral procession for a group of soldiers marshaling, and it was called a war crime by the Russians. That's very interesting. But going back to this triad, so we have the Iraqi forces, we have the drones, And we have, in some cases, here's even the Turks who have vowed to cleanse of ISIS. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, and, you know, and here overall, the news is good. It's positive. ISIS really has lost a lot of ground. I think maybe not many of us realize just how quickly they did sweep through this area that covers a lot of the northern part of Iraq and the southern part of Syria. And, you know, there's a reason they're there. It's the oil pipeline. This is a very well-funded operation. So part of the work over the past year has been trying to shut down both their oil pipeline and their oil smuggling operations, which have really poured cash into the coffers of ISIS, the Islamic State. So part of it has been to try to turn that off. And they've been quite successful there. There have been airstrikes on pipeline areas, airstrikes on what looks to me to be smuggling routes. There's pretty vivid smuggling. You have to have a lot of operation to smuggle oil, and it's done with trucks and donkeys and you name it. So it's pretty easy to see. And they've been successful in shutting down quite a bit of that. You know, so the good news is if the Iraqi forces retake Mosul, which I really looks like they will, the Kurds are holding that northern piece, the Iraqis are moving in, it's tough to do because you are now looking at an urban area and you have to come in on the outskirts, guess where the fighters are going to flee to. I mean, this is what happened when Mosul fell in June of 2014. The Sunni tribes there were more supportive to ISIS, or at least some of them were, and the Iraqi army was basically just shut out, and a lot of them dropped their weapons and ran. What we're seeing now is a much better organized offensive, so I think they'll retake Mosul. When they take Mosul, Bob, they will have captured the self-proclaimed capital of the caliphate. So it's really good to retake Mosul. The question then, of course, is what happens to the ISIS fighters who were in Mosul, experienced in the past from Afghanistan, Iraq, other locations, is that they'll squeeze out and flee to the next spot. There's a city called Raqqa, which is a little bit to the north. Central Command is working now to with its Syrian partners, and these are kind of Syrian rebel forces, a broad band of them, to make sure that they can either control that flow of ISIS fighters out of Mosul or restrict it. And then the key is how many of those get away, and how much time do we spend over the next 5 to 10 years making sure that they haven't somehow slipped into the refugee nets coming up through Europe or slipped elsewhere where they can go off and continue terrorism on a smaller scale. So it's really important both symbolically and for the people of Mosul to retake the city, but also to try to squeeze down on those ISIS fighters that are coming out. And that's where the drones and the surveillance and reconnaissance can become so crucial in the long-term success in this fight.
We've only, what do we got, Nina? 30 seconds. Okay, well, I'm going to wait till right after the break, Dr. Grant, before we go into our next area, which will be Russia. All right, we're going to be talking about the Russians in Europe and their influence in the Middle East. What the heck is going on with Putin? We told him to stay Putin, and he's not. So we'll be right back and talk about that in just a moment. You're listening to Veterans Radio right there on Talk 1600 WAAM Ann Arbor, Michigan. Don't go away. And we're back once again on Veterans Radio talking with Dr. Rebecca Grant, all the way from Washington, D.C. Dr. Grant, before we get into talking about the Russians, whatever, tell us a little bit about what you are doing right now.
About what I'm doing right now.
Are you writing any books?
On our beautiful day here in Washington, D.C., one of my big research projects at the moment is looking at autonomy in military systems, so how we're starting to use more not only drones, but autonomous vehicles on the ground and some autonomy in the way we select targeting intelligence. So I'm pretty deep into doing some research on that topic right now.
Are you consulting? What do I want to, with the Air Force, you are a policy maker, right? You help them put it all together. Is that correct?
That's right. I'm proud to do some work with the United States Air Force on various aspects of their policy, particularly on long-range bomber and on new weapons and long-range plans. And that reminds me of something I wanted to talk about just for a minute before we go to Russia, if that's okay with you, and that is just to go back and talk about those ISIS drones. Can we do that for a minute, Bob?
Yeah, right. I mean, I'm go ahead.
Okay, good, because this is kind of cool, and I've got to give a credit here to a reporter that I know called Tony Capaccio, who has followed this for a long, long, long time, and he asked a really good question to one of our commanders over in Central Command, to General Stephen Townsend, who is our Army 3-star there, about the use of ISIS drones. And wow, you know, we've known for several years that there are Iranian-made and other types of drones that are there, and we've had occasional reports about them being used, but now it's all different. We're at the point where ISIS uses these drones every day, and they use them for the same things that we do, for surveillance, for reconnaissance, and even to control and adjust indirect fires. And so it has been just what they say, a constant and creative use with the ISIS drone corps. And now I want to tell you about the Trojan horse drone. So there they are, an ISIS drone comes over, sputters out, and crashes in the area of some friendly forces. Well, you know, human nature, what do? They have to go over and have a look at it, right? And I'm afraid you can probably guess what happens. It blew up, and there were some casualties among our friendly forces. So we are starting to see a really diabolical, creative use of drones. Now, make no mistake, these are not very high-tech drones. In fact, I think we should just tell our forces, don't touch them. We have way better drones than these guys. But it was a case of hoping that they could capture this enemy drone, and it turned out to have been booby-trapped. So the days of just our side having the drones, it's all gone. The enemy has them now, too. They're not very sophisticated, but they are more than a nuisance. They are becoming more lethal in their battlefield applications. And that's what new that we're seeing in this Mosul fight and the few months leading up to it.
Is there a light at the end of the tunnel?
Yeah, there is a light at the end of the tunnel, and it's a high-energy laser. So, you know, in terms of the drones, it's about shooting them down. And luckily, they are, if you can target them, they're pretty vulnerable to fire from the ground. But I think ultimately we will see maybe 10 years from now, or sooner perhaps, we'll see our ground forces with not only the counter-battery radar using gunshell fire, but perhaps using a battlefield laser to be able to very quickly and silently target and take out these drones. Now, there's another way we've been doing it so far. It's very, very, very clever. Sometimes we use our reconnaissance and surveillance aircraft. Some of these are manned, some of them are helicopters, and some are unmanned. And we can broadcast electromagnetic spectrum, you know, energy waves, and disable the ISIS drones in some cases, send them off course. Very, very clever use of electronic warfare, is what the pilots would call it. And we've been able to take out two ISIS drones that way. So fascinating, lethal, a little bit scary, but a fascinating chapter unfolding in the technology battle, even in this fight around Mosul.
Well, we know that, or at least I would assume, that ISIS doesn't have production facilities. Who's making this stuff and giving it to them?
Yeah, probably Iran in this case. There's a lot of this stuff on the market, and it's not that hard to make. So some of this could be home-built with the GPS guidance that you can buy anywhere in the world. It's not that hard probably to construct some of this. Again, it's not the best stuff. It doesn't have a lot of payload or a lot of range, but they've certainly been able to use it with just what you can buy on the open electronics market. They can put together quite a bit more than what they had in the past. So they have that ability to use them in creative and diabolical ways. And speaking of diabolical, on to Russia and Mr. Putin.
Well, let me start with this, okay? Because I want to start with NATO leaders gear up for Russian threats, okay? For long-term standoff with Russia, ordering multinational troops to Poland. And their divisions, they're talking NATO now, is talking in the Polish president, Andrzej Duda. Yeah, okay. The summit's official host warned that Western democratic values are being undermined by, quote, here's the Polski president, notorious lack of respect for international law. Oh, what a rebuke on Russia. Tell us about that.
That sums it up. Definitely notorious lack of respect. So just an interesting little side note. The Russians recently, they have a kind of a media arm. It's all state-controlled, and they set up an office in Scotland recently in order to just continue to exploit and push on the pressures between England and Scotland and the EU exit and all that. So I think when the Polish leaders are talking about that, they're seeing that Russia is back to a propaganda campaign, among other things. But let's go back to the hard news item of the most interest to me, and that is the deployment of troops. So our policy now, as our Secretary of Defense, Dr. Ash Carter, has made very clear, we must strengthen deterrence in Europe. Background, we don't have nearly the forces in Europe that we had 20 years ago. Much fewer in the way of aircraft, far fewer ground forces. Remember, Bob, we brought everyone home in the 1990s after the Berlin Wall fell, right? It was all over. Russia was pretty quiet. Well, what's happening now, really, is a lot of this is going back. NATO has expanded a lot, so the line is no longer through Berlin. It's much, much, much farther to the east, and that's good. But Putin has been very active indeed, and the response is now officially to send back some rotational troops specifically. And it's not just small stuff. There is an entire rotational brigade that will go over in February. There will be companies, including some striker-equipped maneuver companies with mobile guns. They'll be going as well. And it's not just the United States. The UK, Britain will be sending, I believe, about 800 forces. Where are they going? Mostly to Poland, and then some to the Baltic republics, the independent countries of Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. Making it really complicated is that there is a little wedge of Russian territory around the city of Kaliningrad. They actually border the coast, and this little wedge sits right in amongst the Baltics and creates a very tough problem. It's like a almost like a little island base where they can put aircraft, they can put air defenses. And as the planners look at Europe for the first time in a long time, we see what we've seen in the past. Wow, Russia, wouldn't take them long if they start rolling down those highways. So what Secretary Carter and our NATO allies are doing together is trying to add to the forces that are in Europe and to add the right kinds, the kinds that can blunt an offensive and, most of all, try to convince Putin that it is not worth his time to make any overt military threats, particularly to the Baltic republics, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania.
Because we're going to back that up, right? We're going to back those folks.
That's right. And what we have to remember is these are now NATO members. Countries like South Ukraine, for example, not a NATO member, but Estonia is a NATO member. And under Article 5, we are committed to the defense of all the NATO members. So we have to be credible here. Our air forces, U.S. and NATO partners, have been flying air sovereignty missions in that area for close to 5 years now. They really beefed up the presence so that the Russians couldn't just continue to fly, to overfly the NATO countries. But now we're also seeing ground forces going in. Meanwhile, the Russians, very, very active. They continue to hold a lot of military maneuvers. And they're big. They'll take three divisions and activate them in 24 hours and hold war games. And they're scary because Russian war games typically involve a nuclear scenario as the culmination of the war game. So as you're watching this from a NATO perspective, it just sends a chill down the spine. And it means we really must strengthen our conventional forces by sending these particular types of forces there so that it isn't easy. Europe isn't just rolling out the welcome mat for Russian troops.
We'll be right back for our break right here. You're listening to Veterans Radio, Dr. Rebecca Grant, right here on Talk Radio 1600 Ann Arbor, Michigan. Don't go away. And we're back on Veterans. Whoa. Oh, the band had to get that one in right, okay. We're back with Dr. Rebecca Grant talking all about Russia, Syria, ISIS. Are y'all keeping up with all this? Come on, shake your heads. That's right. That's pretty clear. We just have to remember. But they keep changing their minds. They change their direction. I'm talking all of them, every one of them. Except though, and so, you know, we just sort of have to, I guess we have to sit back and how should I respond? You know, there's a little something here, we respond there, a little something there, we respond there. But the way technology is going, folks, well, I heard a couple of years ago, I was at the Dayton Air Show, and I heard that the F-22, now that's not true now, but back then the F-22 was going to be the last manned fighter. Is that true?
Well, there is the F-35. So I said, no, I don't think it will be the last manned fighter. I heard that, too. It may always be the best. It's a really good one. But we do have the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter in production, which is actually our Air Force and Marine Corps have that fighter now. And the Marines are at what they call initial operational capability. So they have a Marine squadron of F-35s that could be sent into combat on very short notice. It's ready to go, and that's a big achievement for the Marine Corps. They're using the F-35 to replace their Harrier jump jets. Really great capability, but the Harrier is old, and we have some new technology that's a bit better. What was so special about the Harrier is it's able to take off and land from, do vertical takeoff and landing by swiveling the engines down. Pretty neat. And the F-35 variant for the Marine Corps also has this vertical takeoff and landing capability. So the Marines can use it either on an amphibious ship, which is often looks like a small aircraft carrier, but not a lot of deck space. They can use it on an island base. In fact, the Marines have been experimenting with some of the islands out around Guam and Tinian, and whether those can be used as expeditionary wartime airfields for their vertical takeoff F-35s. And they can also use them on roads and other hard surfaces if they were fighting in Europe or up in Norway or something like that. So fascinating capability. And the Marines are real, real happy with their stealthy new jump jet, the F-35. Very, very happy with it indeed.
Well, I should run into that colonel again. find out to correct him. But moving right along, segue, here we go. Something else. There we are. North Korea's fifth nuclear test, called Fanatic Recklessness by the South Korean president. And the detonation was estimated to be the biggest ever in explosive yield. And it's a sign that Kim Jong-un, there we go, is spiraling out of control. Tell us about that.
Oh, my goodness, our North Koreans. We've talked about North Korea on the program before, Bob, and I tell you, it never gets very much better. The only good news here is North Korea really does bring home the quality of the alliances we have in the Pacific, because North Korea is a problem for us, but it's a problem very much also for Japan and, of course, for South Korea. So basically what's going on is that we know that North Korea has been able to essentially develop either a nuclear capability or something very, very close to it. And what they're doing now is trying to develop a robust, long-range missile capability. Why? We don't know. And then, of course, the issue behind this comes back to China. And I think it's clear that China enjoys watching North Korea upset everyone else. I think sometimes they're concerned, too, but the relationship there is pretty close. And you know, obviously the border, but there's more than that to it. And the real wild card here is China, and when and if will China decide to put pressure on North Korea to conform more to the international system. The long story here, of course, is about the rise of China as a world power and its desire to have other sources of power and influence to offset the dominance of the West, and particularly the United States. I think sometimes North Korea's shenanigans, which are scary as the Dickens, are a little bit useful for China, just to keep the West upset and upended. But, scary situation.
Is Kim Jong-un, is he nuts? I mean, no, I'm reading this here. South Korean president said his mental state is gone. You can say that, you know, flippantly, but is there anything to support that? I know it's crazy to even ask that question, but let's talk about that. I mean, here's a guy, here's a leader, three decades of dictatorship, his father and then him and the Korean War, and it's a tinderbox, and yet this guy seems to survive. And how can you be crazy and survive? Tell us about that.
How can you be crazy and survive? Yeah, well, you have to live in your own world, don't you? And that's what North Korea does so effectively. They're very cut off. They are, you know, there's a little bit of internet, but it's completely controlled. The North Korea has a cyber brigade that runs its office out of a hotel in China. Oh, goodness me. So they really do live in their own world. So I'll go with that South Korea knows what they're talking about. If they think the guy's nuts, I think they're probably right. We don't have a lot of evidence that he isn't crazy, do we? So hard to say, but I think that South Korea's concerns are very genuine. And so, again, it kind of goes back to, will China get to a point where they say, whoa, this is just not right, and we have to shut down some of your internet access and stop helping you develop some of these weapons and generally make your life a little more miserable? The question then is, what happens afterwards? Hopefully one day we will see a reunification of South and North. I know there was a time, Bob, when we never thought it would happen with Germany, but it did. Maybe it will still happen for Korea, but until then, they remain a very dangerous player. And for all that I personally watch the rise of China's military power, I think our commanders in the Pacific, if they had to choose, would say that North Korea is and remains the number one threat to stability in the Pacific region.
And I'm still trying to understand. Okay, you mentioned that China wants to be a world. They already are a world power, folks. I mean, what do they got, 2 billion people or something? If they were, they could even economically outproduce, just because of the vast amounts of folks, just and economically. But they already are a power. What is it? I would be if I were the Chinese president. I would be scared, so scared of this crazy delinquent that's going nuts on the world stage. It's going to spill over to them, and it could even wind up to be nuclear and war. Tell us about that.
It could spill over to them, and that's the thing. You know, it's one thing to have him diplomatically rattle other countries, but in the end, China is the one who also pays the price. So I think we're just mystified as to why at this point, given the great growth in China's economy, and you notice they have rescinded their one-child policy. They have some internal issues, too, but basically China has blossomed over the last couple decades, a little too much on the military side, but very much so economically. Why do they want to risk having this wild card, crazy North Korea on their border? So will they take that further step and become a responsible international power and put some restraints on North Korea? Because they do have the ability to do that. I think that's a big question about China's rise. Are they able to grow and mature to their place in the international system? Now, their point of view is they want the international system set up a little bit more for them, and maybe they don't care about how this goes, but they have to face this reality sooner or later.
I like the way you said that about being a responsible world power. There's one thing to be a world power, and there's something to be a responsible world power, which may or may not be going in lockstep with the Chinese overall philosophy on life. But it's good to hear from you that you see that they're looking to be more. But can you put the genie, as far as North, can you put the genie back in the bottle? Tell us about that.
Yeah, I think you can. It's not easy. But we found when we were working with the fall of the Soviet Union back in the late 1980s, early 1990s, and there was a lot of question about, as the Soviet Union broke off and some of the republics that had nuclear weapons in their territory broke apart, and there was something called the Nunn-Lugar Act, two very forcing senators who put this together, and we helped get some control over those nuclear items. So can it be done? Yeah, they can put the genie back in the bottle. But again, do they want to take that step and be responsible? We see some signs that China does. China has actually scaled back its espionage a little bit on the cyber front. They usually send a plane full of aid to humanitarian relief, you know, if there's the earthquake in Japan. Even actually after the Hurricane Katrina in 2005 in the United States, they sent relief to us. So they are taking some steps in that direction, but they'll have to take a big step to take on North Korea, and it would be wonderful if they did. But they certainly have the ability to do it, and without that, without that sign of maturity from China, what we can do is limited. We try to contain, we try to watch what they're up to, and to shore up our defenses and allies in the region, and particularly our missile tracking abilities and ability to defend against at least a small number of missiles. That's sort of where our defense policy is, to try to defend against a few rogue missiles from the number one rogue state of the world, North Korea.
Now, we are and have been since World War II the protector of Japan. We provide it all. I mean, we are it. And economically, it's very important to do business with China. Or I'm sorry, with Japan. And yet, what do you see? Do you see the U.S. in the very near future starting to arm, is that the right word? I'm using an old term, but arm Japan and let them defend themselves, or what is the future?
Good question. And Japan has a very clear mandates about the limits of their defense policy, but they have really stepped up and increased their naval forces and their air forces to provide surveillance of North Korea and of China. So we have cruisers and destroyers that rotate with Japan's self-defense force, Navy. They'll hold the picket line for a while. We'll hold it for a while. They do much the same thing. They've purchased and have a squadron of Navy E-2 surveillance aircraft, and they actually moved this squadron a couple of years ago down to southern Japan so they can have better surveillance and coverage for incoming ballistic missiles and other air traffic in the area. So Japan's military is very professional, obviously very aware. They live in a bad neighborhood, and they are really doing their part to maintain our collective defense in that region. They're really doing a good job in the JASDEC.
It sounds like that's our trump card. Ooh, bad word. That's our card, right? Is that true?
That's our ace. That's our ace, absolutely. Our allies, and particularly our treaty allies in the Pacific, are everything. From Australia up to Japan, it's all about how we operate with our allies.
Do you ever see, well, I know Dr. Grant wrote a book on the B-52, and I know that she's been actually flown in one. I have been in one. No, I didn't fly in it, but I actually was in one before they sealed the darn thing up. And we've only got a few minutes. We got 2 minutes, right? And real quick, I know this is kind of hard. Hey, tell us about the B-52, but give us a 1 minute on how this. And I know you love the airplane as much as I do. I love that airplane, and I go out. Fortunately, it's only about 5 miles from my house on display, and so I can go right up to it and look at this. And tell us, we've got about a minute, Dr. Grant, just about the B-52 right now and what's its role.
The B-52, that is a warplane. You have to swing yourself up into it, and it's all about carrying bombs and gas. There's very little room for human bodies. The electronic warfare officers are downstairs, room for a pilot, a co-pilot, and an observer in the jump seat upstairs. I was privileged to get to sit in that jump seat. You look at the yoke, and in the center of the yoke it says B-52. Beautiful. Old aircraft, a lot of new capability in that cockpit, in navigation and sensors. Terrific aircraft. B-52s remain very busy. Mission number one, nuclear deterrence. And believe me, Putin's watching that. Helping in Afghanistan, shows a force throughout the Pacific. I love the B-52. They are guarding our freedom as they have.
Well, there's the orchestra. They're getting ready, the guys. And we're gearing up. Well, we'd like to have we got 30 seconds. Okay, have you come back in about 30 days. Is that all right? And tell
that
us.
That sounds good.
Is that cool?
Absolutely.
30
talk
days.
More about Mosul, and maybe we'll have taken it back and have more on Putin and North Korea and all that. Love to, Bob.
Thank you, Rebecca. This is Bob Gould for Dale Throneberry and the folks here at WHAM. You are dismissed until next week.